Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce our show to you today, June 18th, 2005. Here's what we have for you today. During hour one of the show, we'll hear an interview with local activist and author Bill Pagum on money for a sustainable community. This is an interview we've been promising you, but having technical problems with, so we're very happy it's here today. Local announcements and commentary will follow. Our second hour will begin with Down to Earth, with New Hampshire environmentalist Jeff White. He'll be talking with former rocket scientist and current Rochester, New Hampshire resident Peter Ajark about his electric car, his planned underground home, and more. We'll end our show with the latest episode of Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. As always, we'll play you some good music in between pieces, so stay tuned. First, for some news culled from the many stories happening in our world with Steve Diamond.
This is Steve Diamond with the news. Our first story is from the New York Times and their reporter in Baghdad. Iraq moved further towards a political stalemate as Shiite political leaders agreed on what they said was a compromise to include Sunni Arabs in the writing of this country's constitution, and Sunnis flatly rejected the offer. In an attempt to defuse a political confrontation with this country's embittered Sunni Arabs, the Shiite-led Constitutional Committee of the Iraqi Parliament decided to give Sunnis 15 seats with full membership on the 55-member committee with an additional 10 advisor positions. The offer was aimed at satisfying the demands of Sunnis, who have insisted that they get at least 25 seats. Sunnis, about a fifth of Iraq's population, are thinly represented in this country's parliament because they refused to vote in national elections in January. But two Sunni political leaders interviewed by telephone shortly after the decision said bluntly that it would be rejected by the majority of Sunni Arabs, whose fringes, which include former Ba'ath Party members and militant Islamists, drive the insurgency. Mehbel al-Sheikh Issa, a member of the National Dialogue Council, a Sunni group that has urged political involvement, said, "Arab Sunni will not accept this number. Advisors, it's not our mission. When we say participation, we mean real participation. If we will not participate in the Constitution, that means an increase of violence in Iraq." Meanwhile, an outspoken supporter of the war, Representative Walter B. Jones, a Republican from North Carolina, said in an interview on the ABC News program This Week that he had changed his position and called for a fixed timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops. And from The Australian, this is news.com.au. A group of U.S. congressmen said they would introduce legislation forcing President George W. Bush to set a plan this year for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq amid declining public support for the war. Senator Kucinich said, "Today is the beginning of the end of the war in Iraq. Our partnership reflects a shifting mood in Congress." White House spokesman Scott McClellan immediately rejected the proposal, saying it would only encourage those who want to see the United States fail in Iraq. "It would be absolutely the wrong message to send to set some sort of artificial timetable. That would be the wrong message to send to the terrorists. It would be the wrong message to send to the Iraqi people. And it would be the wrong message to send to our troops," he said. Mr. Bush has been under growing pressure to set some kind of deadline for the return of 140,000 U.S. troops from Iraq as Iraqis haggle over the shape of a new government and the growing number of U.S. deaths wears down public patience. Mr. Jones, a strong war supporter who coined the term "freedom fries" for congressional cafeterias in protest of France's opposition to the U.S.-led effort, said he believes the time has come to decide when America's work is done in Iraq. He said, "We are giving the Iraqis every reasonable chance for a democracy, but at some point in the near future, the ultimate fate of Iraq will and should rest in the hands of Iraqis." And also from The Australian, "The United States would have to face a painful dilemma on restoring the military draft as rising casualties saw the number of volunteers dry up," a senator warned. Joseph Biden, the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, made the prediction after new data released by the Pentagon showed the U.S. Army failed to meet its recruiting targets for four straight months. "We're going to have to face that question," he said on NBC's Meet the Press TV show when asked if it was realistic to expect restoration of the draft. "The truth of the matter is, it is going to become a subject if, in fact, there's a 40% shortfall in recruitment. It's just a reality," he said. The comment came after the Department of Defense announced the Army had missed its recruiting goal for May by 1,661 recruits, or 25%. Similar losses had been reported by Army officials every month since February. Experts said the latest figure was misleading because the Army had quietly lowered its May recruitment target from 8,050 to 6,700 people. It has been suggested the real shortfall is closer to 40%. During the 2004 election campaign, Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry repeatedly accused President George W. Bush of planning to reinstate a backdoor draft, charges the president vehemently denied. Nearly 1,900 U.S. troops have been killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere since the beginning of the War on Terror in the wake of the September 11th attacks. And next we have an analysis by Ray McGovern from Antiwar.com. Ray McGovern is a former intelligence analyst. London's Sunday Times published the text of another secret briefing document prepared for senior British officials. This one was dated July 21, 2002, 2 days before British intelligence chief Richard Dearlove gave Tony Blair a briefing based on discussions with American counterparts in Washington. At that meeting, British Attorney General Peter Goldsmith pointed out that, quote, "the desire for regime change was not a legal basis for military action." The briefing paper of July 21st shows senior British officials preoccupied with the question of how to fix it so the war would be legal. Pervading the briefing paper is the British leaders' need to square a circle, how to render legal an illegal unprovoked attack on Iraq, or, in the words of the briefing paper, how to go about, quote, "creating the conditions in which we could legally support military action." The document reeks not only of obsequiousness towards the United States, but also wonderment at Washington's policies, particularly with respect to international law. It said, "U.S. views of international law vary from that of the U.K. and the international community. Regime change per se is not a proper basis for military action under international law. Legal bases for an invasion of Iraq are in principle conceivable, but would be difficult to establish because of, for example, the tests of immediacy and proportionality. In lay terms, that must mean that, absent any immediate threat, those who chose to invade and occupy Iraq anyway would flunk the test of proportionality." Grasping at straws, the document raises the possibility of demanding Iraqi acceptance of an unacceptably intrusive UN inspection regime. Quote, "It is just possible that an ultimatum could be cast in terms which Saddam would reject, because he is unwilling to accept unfettered access. However, failing that, or an Iraqi attack, we would be most unlikely to achieve a legal base for military action by January 2003. Iraq wound up tolerating the strictest inspection regime in modern history, and when UN inspectors found Al-Samud missiles with a range greater than that permitted, Saddam allowed them to be destroyed. One can visualize the British lawyers wringing their hands, foiled again." In November 2003, Richard Perle, then a key leader of the Defense Policy Board and a principal intellectual author of the invasion of Iraq, left international lawyers astonished when he told the London audience, quote, "I think, in this case, international law stood in the way of doing the right thing." And next we have an excerpt of an analysis by libertarian Lou Rockwell. The Iraq failure has many precedents. Consider the Soviet failure in Afghanistan. The ostensible goal of the Russian government, which invaded the country by citing security concerns, was to replace a backward religious regime with an enlightened one that brought rights to all, guaranteed a higher standard of living, and put the country on the path to progress. Of course, we all saw through these lies. To us, the Soviet invasion and occupation of Afghanistan was a transparent and brutal exercise of empire. It was evidence of the moral rot in the Kremlin. In the end, the Soviets controlled only the ground underneath their tank treads. It was the last hurrah of an evil empire. Americans need to face the reality that most of the world sees our nation as the new evil empire, and many people in the Gulf region are dedicated to making sure that the Iraq War is the last hurrah for American militarism. How tragic to admit that the analogy is not entirely implausible. The first century philosopher whom George Bush calls his favorite once said, "For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Isn't that also true of a country? And next we have a story from the British Independent. Hundreds of women demonstrated outside Tehran University, calling for greater rights and a boycott of Friday's presidential election. They shouted, "Down with dictatorship and shame on you," in response to the aggressive tactics of police, who tried to prevent protesters from reaching the demonstration yesterday. Huh, that happened to me in New York City, actually. I have come to defend my rights because these people have always oppressed us, said Ferengis Rafati, holding up a Kurdish women's group banner. All the candidates in the election say the same things. They're the same people. It makes no difference if we vote because they will have someone elected among themselves. Some 89 women candidates, including several well-known conservatives, were barred from running for office by a clerical watchdog because of their gender. Dissident groups are split between supporting the reformist candidate, Mustafa Moin, or advocating a boycott. Ibrahim Yazdi, head of the Freedom Movement, faces possible imprisonment, and said, "We believe we can only influence democratization through participation. It's like Stalingrad. We have to fight inch by inch, but we can only win if we participate." But protesters were skeptical. "The candidates talk about rights, but there's no improvement from what they've said before," said the writer and publisher Sohela Beski. She said she wouldn't vote this time. A weeping elderly woman said she had been struck by a policeman as she tried to approach the rally. A journalism student, Shafiq Kanbani, said, "We want the democratic rights of all people to be respected, and we're protesting because they're not." And finally, from Reuters, the Bush administration, under fire for what critics call its failed North Korea policy, expressed confidence on Tuesday that, one way or the other, Pyongyang ultimately would give up its nuclear weapons. Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Hill, the top U.S. diplomat dealing with Pyongyang, said, "One way or another, they're not going to have these systems." And so, the real issue for them is what are the terms under which they'll give them up. On President Bush's watch, the North has declared itself a nuclear power, produced enough plutonium to build at least 6 or 8 nuclear weapons, and made vague threats undermining nonproliferation efforts and confidence in America's ability to ensure peace in Asia, Senator Joseph Biden said. Republican Richard Lugar expressed concern that U.S. goals were being sabotaged by internal administration divisions over policy, confusing both Pyongyang and U.S. allies. So does that mean that Joseph Biden is going to be arrested now as a North Korean agent? I'm not sure. And that's the end of this week's roundup of World News.
See the links of chain binding love. Our own ancestors, our hungry ghosts, closets so full of bones, they won't close. Colored up word mobility, but you've sold down the river. Just another form of slavery. And the whole man-made white world is your master. You and your fancy material world, creating your own image, the supreme God. Your Virgin Mary, your Holy Ghost, claim to be pure of heart, hands that are stained with blood. Colored up word mobility, but you sold down the river. There's another form of slavery, and the whole man-made white world is your master. You and your fancy material world don't see the links of chain binding love. Our own ancestors, our hungry ghosts, closets are full of bones, they won't close. Colored up word mobility, but you've been sold down the river. There's another form of slavery, and the whole man-made white world is your master. See the links of chain binding. You and your fancy material world don't see the links of chain binding.
fancy material world don't see the links of change finding.
That was Tracy Chapman with Material World. Next, we turn to Damon Thomas talking with Bill Pagum on money for a sustainable world.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another interview segment here on Making Waves. I'm Damon Thomas, and my guest today is Bill Pagum. Bill has a degree in chemical engineering from Cornell University and work experience in the petrochemical and nuclear propulsion fields. He is an author, an environmentalist, who's concerned about the health of local economies, and he has written and spoken on the subject of money for a sustainable community. And we explore that subject here with him today. Bill, thank you for joining us here today on Making Waves.
Thank you, Damon.
And Bill, you've made the point in your presentations that by understanding money's history in the United States, exploring its role in a sustainable post-peak oil society, and presenting a guide for spending wisely today, we may yet learn how money may serve us rather than be our master. And you remarked in your presentations, and I'm quoting directly from your writing, that money is a mutual belief about value around which a community is built. As you've said in your writing, it is a medium of exchange for goods and services. Creating a sound monetary framework is a prerequisite for creating a sustainable community. And money may be something that people worry about a lot but not having enough of, but few really understand its true meaning. And that's what I'd like to explore here today. I'm wondering if you could give us a brief account of the history of money in this country as a sort of a backdrop to our larger discussion.
History of money in this country began with colonial script back in the 1750s. The colonial script had really no basic value, but it was mutually agreed upon for the trading of goods and services by the different colonial governments. The colonial script fueled a vibrant economy and was the envy of the Europeans. There wasn't much gold or silver in this area, so that's what they had to use. The English then became jealous of our successes and required us, the colonials, to pay in British pounds. And that caused a big depression and helped usher in the resentments that ended up causing the Revolutionary War. The colonial government then became the United States government. There were a number of federal banks. A number of them, they mostly were scandal-ridden, and Jackson eventually killed the bank and left the country without any debt.
This was President Andrew Jackson?
Right. President Andrew Jackson. The country got along with state chartered banks for another number of years. Lincoln, in order to fund the Civil War, issued greenbacks by government edict. That was a fiat currency that bypassed the banks. After he issued a number of the greenbacks, halfway through the Civil War, he went to the banks and he finally went back to the banks and issued issued bonds, and the currency was based on debt and interest. After Lincoln's assassination, there was a basic creation of a debt-based money system. That's something that the populace later on in the 1800s tried to reform. They wanted based on interest-free silver. There was a big battle between gold and silver, and William Jennings Bryan in the 1890s was their presidential candidate. Unfortunately, he was defeated, and the populace, which had taken over a lot of state governments, were eventually removed from power. After that, gold was then created as a the standard for our government.
What, in your view, is today's problem with the current money situation, based as it is on those two factors?
The current money system is, well, what happened was after the creation of the Fed, it finally more and more centralized the money supply into New York, and in 1933 it was illegal for the U.S. citizens to own gold, and in 1971 it became a non-convertible currency with gold. It was backed by gold up until 71, and then the foreign governments couldn't exchange their dollars for gold. Soon after that, the dollar became a petrodollar, and that's how it was agreed upon convention that people could buy oil in terms of dollars. So that's what made dollars valuable after that. But really, since 71, the dollar has lost about 80% of its value, and it is not backed by anything in particular. It's backed by the U.S. taxpayer.
You've said in your presentations, in your writings, that gold backing no longer exists, as you've alluded to here, and that the debt generates enormous interest payments for taxpayers, which you just suggested, and even greater interest benefits for the Fed and its member banks through the fractional reserve banking. This debt, as you've said, must be financed by ever more growth in the economy, or by printing ever more dollars to use in the economy. And as you've remarked, the system is like a gigantic pyramid scheme, in the sense that unregulated growth is straining the resources available to us on the planet, even while it's creating harmful byproducts that will change the climate and adversely affect the health of its inhabitants. When the limits to growth are reached and market saturation is accomplished, the country, like any company, must either reinvent itself or collapse in on itself. Could you comment any further on this? And I'm taking those remarks straight from some of your writings that I'm looking at here. Could you comment or elaborate any further on that point?
Right. Well, when you have a lot of debt, the way to finance that is through growth. The problem we have now is growth is getting limited, and some of the factors that are limiting growth are an aging population, ever more scarce resources, an unstable fiat money system, that's the dollar, because the dollar is a fiat money system now, and the buildup of waste in our environment. And as a result of those four factors, unless we can come up with some real solutions, we're in for some problems. And one of the problems that hasn't really been talked about yet, but it's getting more notice, is peak oil. We use oil every day. It's sort of the blood that keeps our economy going. A few facts here that I've gotten from going to a lecture by Richard Heinberg in Plymouth State last month was that for every 4 barrels of oil that are consumed, only 1 barrel is discovered. There's world supply of oil is not being replenished as fast as it needs to be. The growth of world consumption is growing, and it's oil is being depleted. It's not being replaced fast enough to keep up with the rise in growth, and that's going to cause an increase in price, and eventually it might cause shortages. There may not be enough oil for everybody to go around.
And I think for a moment of how much of the economy is literally fueled on oil, certainly in the manufacturing sector, the products that we obtain and buy, all have oil components or are manufactured through the use of oil in one sense or another. And this concept that you've mentioned, peak oil, that the world may be at a point, or is at a point, we stand at a precipice where we've used more oil than what we have remaining, which is the basic concept, as you've suggested, behind peak oil, and now we're on the downward part of that curve, and that this is recognized through the industry. The fact that we're at that point certainly has ramifications for the economy, I would think, and I'm wondering if you could comment on that, since so much of the economy is tied into oil and oil production. Just wondering what it means to this country and to the world if we're emerging into an age of declining oil production, and what that means for the economy, and what that means for the average person.
Well, we're still not 100% sure we're at the point of declining oil discoveries, But just for an example, the U.S. Has 5% or less of the world's population and uses 25% of the world's oil. Now, our consumption is rising, and the world's consumption of oil is rising also. The number of large fields that have been discovered in the last few years hasn't kept up with the expected amount to replace the current reserves. So it's a question of, you know, there's a lot of question out there if we're at the peak now, but the peak oil idea is beginning to be talked about. And it might happen now, it might happen in 5 years, but somewhere around that time. The United States production, this discoveries for the United States peaked in the 1930s. Oil production here peaked in about 1970. And that's where OPEC began to corner the market and was able to increase the price. World discoveries peaked in the 60s. If you notice, there was a 40-year lag time between oil discovery and oil peak in the U.S. And if you think of the 60s as being the peak for oil discoveries in the world, about 40 years later is about now, where, you know, things just aren't, we're not finding as much oil. Now, oil could be found in other places, but it's getting harder to get the high-quality, easily recovered oil that we're used to. And the other part of that equation is there's still oil in the ground. It just will be taking more and more energy to extract, so it'll be more and more expensive. And one of the ramifications of that is for every calorie of food that you eat, and this is the small calories, C-A-L, not K-calories, it takes 10 calories. Calories is a unit of energy. It takes 10 calories of oil to produce that. And so that's how dependent our food supply system is on oil. From pesticides and herbicides and fertilizer and transportation, it's all very interdependent with our need for oil. And that's not including our manufacturing, which has diminished, but all our packaging of goods, and it's just a lot that we depend on for oil, and we may have to get used to doing with less. That's what sustainability is all about, is trying to do more with less and without as much waste. There are some possible alternatives for that.
Yeah, and that's what I'd like to explore with you, actually, that regardless of when we might pinpoint when this post-petroleum age might begin or really kick in, whether it's a year from now or 5 years or 10 or 30 years from now, that eventually we will emerge, in given the declining global oil production, into a post-petroleum age, whenever that is, and we can agree or differ as to when that might be. But I'm interested in looking at the framework for community in this post-petroleum era, and I'm wondering how that might develop, along what lines. I think you've suggested in your talk that the framework for community in the post-petroleum era might develop along three different lines: communal, or local, or regional, and then how that might impact on national or state borders. I'm wondering if you can give our listeners some of your views with respect to the possible options for a new economy in the post-petroleum age.
I'd like to try to explain that we probably need to redefine community and money. Community's Latin root is to give among each other. I guess we're going to try to have to find some cooperation among each other to try to get things done. And that's more along the lines of monastic, traditional, and frontier societies. Money might be more looked at as barter, or back to colonial script, or commodity-based. And commodity-based is probably a better example. Some of the ways to keep money in circulation is with a demurrage. It's what you might call a sustainability fee, that the money actually becomes worth slightly less as the year progresses. And that keeps people spending. It also would pay for the commodity that is held in reserve. Maybe it's a basket of commodities, and if the money is tied to the value of that basket of commodities, it can be self-regulating, inflation-proof, and able to withstand the test of time. The other idea is living for the seventh generation. It's a Native American idea, and that's where a council would get together and try to figure out, for every big decision, how that decision would affect the children of the seventh generation in the future. And that would be looking forward more like 120 to 150 years from now, not so much looking at the kind of quarterly earnings statements that companies need to these days to stay in business.
Indeed, that's a very different philosophy, to look ahead into the future seven generations down the road and to ask, how will our actions today impact the children seven generations from now? It's a very obviously a very different emphasis, and one that's far more encompassing of our actions toward each other and the planet for several generations of persons. And yeah, that is a lot of forethought when you realize, as you mentioned, that most businesses today just look toward meeting the next quarterly earnings statements, hardly a consideration for what's best for the community much further on down the road. I am intrigued by your discussion of these options, Bill, and I'm wondering if there's anything more you could elaborate on with respect to how economies may evolve under a different scenario, given it's impacted, of course, by the decline in global oil. I wonder if you could elaborate more on these alternative economies, if I could refer to it that way.
What I'd like to do is talk more about what we can do now. It's the idea of changing the economy is possible. I think there's several examples of different ideas out there. There's Ithaca Hours, which is a script based on the value of labor at $10 an hour. There's also something more local up in Maine called the Maine Time Dollar Network, and they're using service hours to exchange among each other for goods and services. There's other ideas I've been working with. I'm going to try to maybe elaborate that on another time, but there's something called the WIR, W-I-R, in Switzerland that does $6 billion worth of goods and services exchanged in a business circle with about 70 or 80,000 people participating. There's also a Solari model that Catherine Austin Fitz has been talking about and trying to establish in several areas of the country, in California now, in Montana. What I think is more instructive right now is education, and I've come up with a chart and some incentives to support your local community. Some of that is having to realize that national chain stores siphon away dollars from the community. If money spent in local stores, the dollars stay in the community longer. In a way to quantify that for every dollar spent in the local community, in the local economy, at local stores, you're able to generate five extra dollars, and that's wealth that stay longer in the community. If you think of dollars as coming from New York, cycling around the community for a limited time and going back to New York, when you spend in a local community store rather than a national chain store, you're able to make those dollars go further, and the factor is about five times. There's a couple of ways we did the math on that, and some in the literature as well. I have a chart that explains how to try to go about that. There are two types of transactions. Near the top of the chart are helpful transactions. At the bottom, there's what I call hurtful transactions to a community. Near the top, at helpful transactions, you have a tendency towards cooperation, independence, and self-realization. Near the bottom, with hurtful transactions, there's a tendency for competition, centralized power, and corporate control. There's a number of columns. This chart can be found on my website, but...
And your website is?
It's www.billpagum.com, and that's B-I-L-L. P as in Peter, A, G, U, M as in Mary, .com. There's several columns in this chart. There's banks, businesses, personal, and capital and stock. And what it really means is for banks try to save in credit unions and savings banks. They're better than other types of banks. For businesses try to work it going to cooperative type businesses, CSAs, that's community supported agriculture, health food stores, your local grocery and meat market, also thrifts and NGOs to set up business. For personal, you can do gifting and tithing, service hours that you can volunteer or trade for goods and services. Like I mentioned, there's scripts and commodities and hours that can be created and bartered to between people. As far as capital and stock for storage of value for money, you can, I guess have gold coins and silver coins. You could invest in green companies or green type funds. But the best thing to do is try to keep your money local. And if you can, it's our investment industry is channeled towards New York, but if there's a way to try to keep some of that local by investing in yourself, your family, your community, your business, that's the way to do it. That's the way to spend your money.
What I gather from this chart is that it illustrates how a consumer can use his or her dollars to foster cooperation and fair trade over the exact opposite, over competition and free trade. And those are polar opposites that you've listed when you refer to this chart of yours, cooperation versus competition, independence versus, its opposite, which is centralized power, and of course self-realization versus corporate control. And that's simply by education. People can be convinced to spend their dollars locally in locally owned businesses and cooperatives or buy from local producers. And those have ramifications, as you've just highlighted, to the community. By saving their money in locally owned credit unions or banks, or investing in local companies or green companies, by patronizing companies that treat the environment and their employees and their suppliers fairly, they can contribute to the overall health and well-being of their community, is what I'm gathering from what you're saying.
There's benefits such as increased prosperity, better paid people, more equitable distribution of wealth, and that results in a broader tax base, better schools, less social problems, and less crime, and a happier community.
I'm just wondering if you could explain, just make it clear to our listeners, how it's possible for that to occur. If you multiply the number of local transactions of a given earned dollar and keep it within the community, how it does lead to those results. I hope I'm not repeating myself by asking that, but I think you've alluded to that. But just so our listeners are clear on the subject of how local spending promotes this greater prosperity, if you could maybe elaborate on that in some way.
Well, one way to look at it is if you're able to double the amount of money you spend locally, you'll double the sales volume of the community. The profits of those businesses will go up by a slightly larger factor because fixed costs go up at a smaller degree than variable costs. And the businesses themselves are valued at three or four times their profits, so that you're talking about an increase of wealth of about a factor of 10. Now, that means you increased by twice the number of dollars spent, and you've increased wealth by a factor of 10. What that means is for every fractional increase of dollars spent in the community, you're generating $5 of extra money to be used locally. That has a multiplier effect. It's sort of like when you spend locally, you have a pinball effect of those local suppliers, that restaurant that you go to that's a family-owned restaurant. They'll go and buy local places to supply their restaurant, and the money will stay in the community longer. And if you go to a national chain, what happens, the money there is you go to the checkout counter, you'll swipe your card, and when they debit your account, the money goes straight to some place like Arkansas, and from there China, or it'll go to New York City and help that company with its high P.E. ratio of 20 to 25 times earnings, whereas a local business only has the P.E. ratio of, say, 3 or 4 times earnings. But what that doesn't tell you is the local business give back to the community five times as much or more than a large corporate, transnational corporation.
Do you think that the advent of peak oil, whenever that occurs, will push us, will force us into these new economies, or are they evolving regardless? Or is it some combination of those two? I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
I think things are going to become more expensive, and we're going to have to be forced to cooperate among each other. These things are happening now. I mentioned the Maintime Dollar Network, which is going national in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Something like that helps people with little cash to spend, but with a lot of skills. And
could you describe for our listeners a bit about how that program works?
I'm not an expert on what the program's about, but what I think it is you have a few skills to offer. You have on a computer, you add hours for service that you do for others, and then you debit those hours when you get a product or service from somebody else. There's a good exchange of services and goods when there's a shortage of money to make that all happen, and otherwise wouldn't happen. The Swiss model has been around since 1933, and they've done, like I said, a lot of they have a lot of people involved, a lot of businesses involved, but they're short on workers. They're not as much into the worker scene, and I'm working on a model that would combine education, time dollars, with a business model where there's credits in a business circle, and forming some sort of cooperative. But the future, I think, if we're lucky to embrace it, will be more cooperation and the formation of maybe cooperatives to get things done, and less waste. Things are going to be things could get very uncomfortable. Because we rely so much on transportation. Half of our oil goes into transportation costs. What we would need to do is try to eliminate waste. Driving around in your car by yourself is one of the most wasteful forms of energy usage imaginable. That's what I learned at the lecture from Richard Heinberg over in Plymouth State. It actually is more wasteful than being on a jet aircraft with, several hundred other people. So, on a per-person, per-mile basis. So, hopefully we'll start the process now of forming alliances. There's political things that can be done. In Maine, there's been an alliance of Greens and Blues, the environmentalists and the workers. There's also a kind of unconventional alliance between small and local businesses and those same groups. I'm working on a sustainability game. The woman involved with that design now is someone that really wasn't, or my girlfriend too. Neither one were that interested in this type of thought process, but after some reflection and seeing the chart and paper, they realized that it's to their benefit to try to support the local economy, the local downtowns, and not so much the transnational corporations, because let's face it, everybody, most of America is powered by small business, and trying to build alliances with small business and with environmentalists and workers, we can then form coalitions to enact legislation. You know, one of the things that happened in Maine was they were able to form a fair trade commission. That's educating the people and politicians to the value of keeping jobs at home, not outsourcing jobs, and being against CAFTA, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement. So that's some of the things that I think are possible. And like I said, spend locally, save locally, and invest locally. Invest in yourself, your family, your business, and your community.
You've been listening to Making Waves on WSCA LP. 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Damon Thomas. My host has been Bill Pagum, and we've been discussing money for a sustainable community. Bill is also an author. And Bill, I want to make reference to a book. You've just published a novel called A No-Life Story. And I'm wondering if you could tell the listeners a little bit about that and how they might be able to access your book.
Right. Well, my novel is about a character that kind of bumbles along and meets a lot of fringe people that you wouldn't necessarily meet in a novel. It's not something that's ordinarily written about. The book can be obtained on my website, BillPagum.com, or locally independent bookstore, River Run.
And River Run is located where?
And locally owned and independent bookstore, River Run, in Portsmouth on Commercial Alley.
And Bill, I'm wondering if there are any concluding thoughts or remarks that you would like to stress to our listeners to have them take note of as we wrap up here today.
Well, I'd just like you to think about how they can use the dollar bills in their wallet to try to vote for the kind of community and the kind of local economy that they'd like to have. Voting once every 2 years or every 4 years doesn't always make the difference you want. But every day we vote with our money, and by determining where you shop, you can try to use buck power to influence the economy. You know, buck power in a global economy, that's what I call my chart. And the subtitle is How to Use Shopping to Build a Sustainable Community. So, try to avoid the chains, the transnational corporations, and try to work to, buy at the local shops that are family-owned, that get to know your name, and can do you a lot of side service as well, which you wouldn't be able to get at those larger corporations. And hopefully we can build a more of a cooperative type community that can get us through what might be some rough times ahead.
Bill, I want to thank you for your time here, and I want to thank our listeners. I hope you've benefited from the knowledge on the show. If you have any questions, once again, I refer you to Bill Pagum's website, and that once again is www.BillPagum.com. And any other questions regarding the show also can be addressed to the radio station, NWSCA, at 430-9722.
Plaster your home with a furniture loan, sing. jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. If you show me you need it, I'll let you have credit. I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. Just bring me back two for the one I lend you, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. When your car you're losing and sadly you're cruising, I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. I'll come in foreclose, take your car and your clothes, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. When bugs get your cotton and times they are rotten, I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. I'll come down and help you, I'll rape you, I'll scalp you, singing I'm a jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. A jolly banker, a jolly banker am I. A jolly banker, a jolly banker am I.
That was Jolly Banker by The Jolly Bankers. And now let's hear from Steve Diamond again, this time with some original commentary.
And next we have a column I wrote featured on nhindymedia.org. The series of the column is called Between a Rack and a Hard Place. This particular one is called Ignorance is Strength. It's a 1984-inspired analysis of current progress and corner-charting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Don't worry. The scandalous actions at Abu Ghraib and all of America's other detention facilities have been dealt with. The camera cell phones that subjected the public and America's reputation to such damaging images have all been confiscated. You can now forget about the tens of thousands of detainees being tortured and move on to happier thoughts. The news outlet that so carelessly reported that Korans were being flushed should think twice before engaging in journalism that sparks deadly riots in the Arab world. A military investigator concluded that Korans were urinated and stepped on by guards, never flushed. Simply put, Newsweek got the name of the investigative report the administration official cited that stated Korans were flushed completely wrong. Such a flagrant lack of fact-checking should get them shot or their offices closed, like we do in Iraq to journalists who are not in bed with the U.S. military. The memo leaked in Britain documenting that the Bush administration tailored the intelligence to justify the inevitable war on Iraq demonstrated a serious intelligence vulnerability, whereby a whistleblower was able to leak documents without being held accountable for their espionage. History will judge George Bush after Iraq and Afghanistan are pacified and all the relevant files are carefully archived in the memory hole. Shredded, then burned. We must all stand united if the American empire is to succeed, or the terrorists have already won. Do not attempt to learn embarrassing facts at the library. You are being watched. Remember that America remains strong, good, caring, and modest, and is the chosen nation to carry out God's will. You are to ignore all information that might tell you otherwise. Our constant reassurances that we are turning the corner in Iraq do not mean that we are going around in circles. The situation is constantly improving. Long live Big Brother. And there are a number of citations for this story you can read, including studentsfororwell.org, and an excellent picture of what the Statue of Liberty might look like in the near future.
Right, run till the enemy's clean out of sight. Ship out your daughters and ship out your sons. They won't return till the battle is won. War for the righteous and war for the good. War for the children in your neighborhood. Bring home the victory, bring home the bride. Bring home the bodies of soldiers who've died. But it's not enough for the villains to fall. Bring home the money to pay for it all. We pay with our taxes and pay with our sons. Give up our freedoms and buy bigger guns. Enter the time of perpetual war. You mess with us and we'll even the score. The jackals, the devils are living the dream. Driving the red, white, and blue war machine. And when we're victorious,
when we're victorious,
and our battle is won,
our battle is won,
death waits in a black limousine.
Black limousine.
There's room for everyone.
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 Everyone.
To the right, run till the enemy's clean out of sight. Ship out your daughters and ship out your sons. They won't return till the battle is won. War for the righteous and war for the good. War for the children in your neighborhood. Bring home the victory, bring home the pride. Bring home the bodies of soldiers who've died. But it's not enough for the villains to fall. Bring home the money to pay for it all.
That was Bring Home the Money by Coiler. To hear previous shows of Making Waves, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show or that you want to help us, and we'll find something for you to do. Also, you can call the station in the next hour to talk to Joanne and get more information or have those websites repeated to you. The number is 430-9722.